this idea that the public imagination has been captured in certain ways by specific topics in the cyber realm, I really think of that as us sort of, we're looking where the light is, right? Where when we see something that's identifiable or potentially understandable to laymen, I think we seize upon it as a solution or as the dispositive way to understand the problem. And so it's the effects are quite disturbing, but they can be interesting to look at. And in the software accountability space, I would suggest we think about sort of the cultural reasons why this is happening. One of the reasons why we're so resistant to software accountability mechanisms of any kind, in fact, we shut down the conversation before people in the conversation can know what we're talking about, it's actually because code itself is a very special currency in the culture of the moment. Code is the currency of innovation.
I'm Quinta Jurassic, and this is the mother of all Lawfare podcasts, April 15th, 2017. The importance of cybersecurity policy will only increase as time goes on, but the location of these issues at the intersection of technology and law often makes specific policy questions particularly difficult to iron out. A new book by Richard Harrison, Director of Operations and Defense Technology Programs at the American Foreign Policy Council, and Trey Herr, Fellow with the Belfer Center's Cybersecurity Project at the Harvard Kennedy School, takes a crack at this problem by providing a handy guidebook to cybersecurity policy areas. Susan Hennessy sat down with Trey, along with Jane Chong, Deputy Managing Editor of Lawfare and National Security and Law Associate at the Hoover Institution, and Robert Lee, Non-Resident National Cybersecurity Fellow at New America, to talk about the book, titled Cyber and Security, Navigating the Perils of the Next Information Age. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 219, Cyber and Security.
So Trey, you released this book, Cyber and Security, in November 2016.
Right.
You may have done so with a different set of assumptions about sort of what the future of cyber policy might look like. Do you think the sort of, you know, talk to us about why you wrote the book, and whether or not you think that the somewhat surprising circumstances, the outcome of the election, changes kind of the basic policy recommendations or the way we should be thinking about if these ideas still have relevance, you know, some 5-6 months later.
Sure. No, and thanks for hosting us. It's great to get a chance to parse this out sort of in looking backwards a little bit. The book evolved out of some conversations that Rich Harrison, the co-editor, and I had with congressional staffers, and we were struck by this recurring theme of sort of lack of underlying issue area knowledge, as well as the overwhelming sensibility that everyone was trying to deal with every issue simultaneously. So the committee staff that were dealing with national security issues would suddenly be talking about cybercrime, and the groups that were dealing with internet governance were quickly then as well sucked up into the national security debate. So what we had attempted to do was try to structure cybersecurity, sort of in air quotes, into four overlapping but relatively distinct policy areas. The first looking at the security of actual devices and systems, where Jane has her chapter on software liability. The second looking at cybercrime and the sort of adversarial relationship and innovating new attacks and new forms of security. The third looking at internet security governance, so the broadest scale political processes to deal with security, not on a system-to-system level, and then military cyber operations, actually would turn out to be a fairly small part of the overall puzzle, but one that dominates a lot of the conversation. So the book was intended to serve as both a primer with these four sort of distinct chapter sections being an introduction to the area, and then to offer what we saw as sort of 16 pressing policy issues, things that were going to become a major point of discussion or debate in the community over the next couple of years, spread between those four sections.
So whenever you say in the community, what community are you talking about? Who do you think are sort of the relevant actors, relevant interest groups in this very, very broad area?
Absolutely. I think for us, the primary constituency is the early to mid-career staffer who has responsibility over a particular issue. And the goal was to try to give them a tool that helped move the discussion away from this recurring sort of omnibus legislation and into more discrete policy problem and solution relationships. So it's written in an accessible fashion. I think there's some areas that probably dive a little bit into the weeds, but that's intended to be a resource, not necessarily just something you'd sit down and jot through in one sitting. And the feedback I think that we've had so far what's been surprising to me is it's actually now gotten picked up as well as an introductory text in some college classes. I know a number of schools, including Fletcher, have started to assign this as part of their sort of what is cybersecurity course sections of it, as a way to introduce those students as well to these topics. So it's panned out a little bit differently, but I think better than we'd hoped.
So it sounds like you're really sort of thinking about this in terms of congressional staffers, sort of that part of the policymaking piece here. Whenever you think about the relationship between sort of the career civil service and the executive branch, private industry, is it that you see sort of a very specific education gap in Congress that isn't occurring elsewhere? Or is there something about just the fact that these are the people that we're going to have to take the pen on the issues? You know, why congressional staffers in particular, considering how many people are sort of stakeholders?
Absolutely. So I think the answer is kind of twofold. The first is there's nothing unique to what congressional staff do or don't know. There's a lot of constituencies here in D.C., but also in the private sector that don't necessarily have the greatest grasp on some of the underlying technological issues and policy conundrums that we're talking about. But the second is that the reason to focus on the legislature is it becomes the go, no-go debate on a lot of solutions. And so in the discussion throughout the book, there's a lot of consideration of executive branch efforts, regulatory efforts. There's a lot of discussion of administrative law, especially in Jane's piece. And I think that is a point of emphasis, not necessarily because that's something Congress is going to be taking action on, but it might be an issue area where they could step back, or a solution set where they're not going to play as big a role. And the thing that's been surprising to me, at least coming from academia, is that's as important a process as anything else, is really lane setting and trying to establish for the staff, but I think the policymaking apparatus, every time you go to interact with it, what's your set of responsibilities and what's a set of solutions that you can implement, and then what don't you have to worry about? That became, I think, as important as what you can do.
Right, so one of the things that's sort of interesting, and I'll kick it to Jane or Rob to jump in as well, is that the authors here are from rather different communities, right? So Jane is an attorney, Rob has a technical background, there are people with sort of non-legal policy experience, private industry experience. So again and again, whenever we talk about sort of cybersecurity or cyber policy issues, there's sort of this concern that, you know, lawyers don't know enough about technology or technologists don't know enough about policy. It's sort of a lot of the conversation centers, I think, on the idea that there is this mythical person that's going to emerge that knows how to code and knows the law and has this really sharp policy and political sensibilities. And we're going to have sort of a crop of these people that are going to hatch in a cabbage patch and then cybersecurity will be fixed. That's never struck me as particularly realistic, right? I mean, I always think it's a good idea to think about that kind of interdisciplinary education, but I tend to think people kind of have their specialties and then they bring it together. So as you guys were constructing this book and thinking about legal issues and technical issues and the ways that these various things sort of overlap, how do you think about that issue of sort of what's the right balance of law, policy? You know, are we going to have to figure out a way to just educate people into this, you know, mythical creature? Or is this more about sort of having a different type of conversation? Sort of how are you thinking about that?
So I think for us, the goal is not, right, absolutely to create the mythical cabbage patch creature.
But they do exist. Trey is one of them. So.
I wouldn't say that, definitely. I think it's more about trying to create a common set of understanding and a little bit approaching something like a common language so that, I'll give you an example. There is a staffer on a committee, I won't name, who has a computer science background. And she has been incredibly persistent and I think somewhat effective at advancing a discussion within her committee about a very niche set of issues regarding internet governance, specifically the oversight of the certificate authorities process. And that's an unusual situation. We wouldn't expect, and I don't really think we'd want, every staffer working on cyber to have had a CS background to also have gone and gotten a JD or a PhD or an MD or any of these issues. So the goal with the book is to take these people from different communities and perspectives and say, here's how I'm looking at this particular problem. And I think through the editing process, what we tried to do was to unify a little bit of the language we were using. It's over actually some surprisingly small things, too. The way people talk about capabilities versus malware versus attacks versus breaches varies a lot depending on the background you come come from. So trying to create a little bit more consistency there hopefully gives people a more unified picture of how to talk about these things, so that when you're working on an issue, you can turn around and talk to a computer scientist, can talk to a lawyer, can talk to somebody in the executive branch, and have a little bit more of a sort of singular set of understanding of how to talk about these problems.
I mean, the intersectionality that you point to, Susan, it's like a pet, it's actually a pet project of mine. It's the fundamental thing I'm interested in, is not even cyber liability, but how people talk about cyber liability. So you've, I think, really hit on something that can be a problem, but also a strength in the field. When I say it's a problem, I mean, you do have a lot of people who might fundamentally misconceive or just misunderstand a broad idea. An example would be a tech specialist who doesn't really understand what liability entails. What does it mean? If you don't know what it means, it can sound like, oh, you're talking about a lot of lawsuits, and that sounds really bad. And so now let me make a technological argument for why that's really a terrible idea, or a market-based argument for why it's a terrible idea. Oh, but we have this, we now are like, we're talking past each other, because the lawyer is talking about a much more expansive conception of liability. The technologist is talking about a very limited nuclear button sort of understanding of liability. And so now you're actually not even having an argument. You're just missing each other. So you actually see, I think, a ton of this happening in the cyber field, because there are only so many, you know, cabbage patch hatched trays out there who can speak knowledgeably on, you know, various sides of the issue. And even to the extent we do have those people, they only have so much time, so they can't address all of them. So I think it's really good when you have people who have certain professional or educational biases, because what ends up happening is they might sort of overplay their hand. They might emphasize, for example, what a great idea liability is, and then you have other people to sort of respond to that argument from the technological perspective or from whatever the other perspective is, who can like help that dialectic and help the dialectic evolve out of that. And so I like to think, for example, that my chapter in this book tries to do that. It tries to point out the ways in which people are misunderstanding and honestly overfearing what liability means. And it's when we point that out that we can then move forward and have a productive conversation about why, you know, we can take a nuanced approach to cyber liability.
So, Rob, come in and tell me, like, why we're 100% wrong and only technologists know how to do this. And, like, represent your you know, your peers in that. I've heard many, many times tell me how if you've never written a line of code, you should put duct tape over your mouth and not participate in this conversation.
No, not at all. I actually agree with a lot of what y'all are saying and sort of the perspective that y'all bring. I think there's definitely a component of this discussion that needs to be more technical, but it doesn't have to be like writing lines of code, and it doesn't have to be necessarily deep, deep technical discussion. I find that even in the technical community, when people go too much in the weeds, they confuse each other from different little micro communities. You know, IT networks, as an example, compared to SCADA or operations technology networks, have vastly different needs. And so we see those two technical communities colliding all the time. So what I would say is more important is having a common language and having a common understanding and making sure that the policy narrative and the larger discussion is at least driven by what is technically feasible. I mean, we see on a regular basis terminology that we use and already have definitions around and already have an understanding of around in the technical community get misrepresented in policy in a way that just causes confusion. And this actually ties into the chapter that I wrote for the book, which was on industrial control systems and critical infrastructure. And I recommended a model for discussion around how you can invest in security and critical infrastructure called the sliding scale of cybersecurity. It details at a high level, completely non-technical, the five areas of investment that can even be done. And as a good example of the disparity in the larger community, one of those categories is called active defense. And it's something that we've done in the community for a long time and have had narratives, especially in the industrial control system community, on it being the right choice for defense in many situations, where all it amounts to is people monitoring their own networks and performing response. To highlight that disparity, we have a bill that's been introduced to Congress in the last month titled the Active Cyber Defense Certainty Act. And what Congress is calling active defense is the ability to hack back people. So this is one of those areas that I think that we can do a better job, and it has nothing to do with coding. It has to do with recognizing that a term active cyber defense is already well established in the technical community for completely defensive-based actions, and now we have policymakers using the terminology in a way to describe what otherwise should be illegal activity.
Right, so sort of thinking about your chapter and going a little bit deeper into it, one of sort of the challenges that I've always observed in sort of the conversation about critical infrastructure has been sort of a threshold definition problem, right? That there are areas in the law in which critical infrastructure or buckets of critical infrastructure are sort of broadly defined. Yet every time we sort of have the conversation about security and critical infrastructure, it seems as though we have to go through the process of redefining it all over again, right? So, you know, our voting system is part of critical infrastructure? Is Sony part of critical infrastructure? It always sort of strikes me as, you know, if everything is critical, then nothing is critical, that we're still having some sort of line drawing issue. So whenever you sort of approach the topic for the purposes of your chapter, like how do you think through just what are you talking about whenever you talk about critical infrastructure and cybersecurity?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a fair point. And I agree with you as well, that too many people are trying to define everything to be part of critical infrastructure, because if you reverse out the discussion, at some level, pretty much everything's connected, and it's all critical to somebody's infrastructure, whose infrastructure is eventually part of actual critical infrastructure, and so it creates this really tangled web. And I do think that we need a better way of approaching it than just redefining it every time. The way I approached it is very much cheating, in the sense that I routinely just define out and say, you know what, the industrial control system part of critical infrastructure debate is completely different. And that's the approach most in the community of the industrial control system security has taken it, where we say, okay, you want to talk about financial sector, you want to talk about voting systems, that's fine, but it is inherently different when we talk about industrial networks. Power grid, water filtration, oil and gas.
Yeah, so explain to me why that is, right? So why are they completely different?
Sure. So although every industry has their priorities and every industry has their tailored approach, there has been a massive disconnect between what I'll just define broadly as the IT security community, the information technology security community, and what goes on in operation technologies. Many of the things that may make sense across all of the different IT sectors, like vulnerability disclosure, may make no sense for industrial control system community. Actually, well over 90% of the vulnerabilities that come out with regards to industrial control systems have no impact whatsoever to increasing the risk of operating those industrial control systems. There's just been a large disparity where IT security practices have been sort of largely brought over to industrial control system environments in a way that can actually introduce risk and bring those networks down. And more importantly, and I think this is probably the biggest piece of this larger narrative, is that fear of those critical infrastructures, if you will, the industrial critical infrastructures, fear of what can happen to those has driven a lot of policy discussions, right? The power grid going down. In my chapter, I referenced this 2013 attack, or quote-unquote attack, on a small water dam in upstate New York. There's narratives that have formed to drive policy discussions very much in the same way counterterrorism was introduced to drive cybersecurity discussions, in a way that's not nuanced and not represented by reality. So I was a perfect example of this. I was at a conference this past week where a lot of DC policymakers and folks were exchanging ideas and discussions, and some congressional members talking about what do we do for when the power grid goes down. And there was only two people, myself and Tim Conway, who actually had any experience in industrial control systems at all. And we were surprised the lack of knowledge around national level policies and programs for this space that already exist. At one point, senior cabinet members were discussing the need for a national level exercise to increase the responsiveness to a power grid failure. And in fact, we've had that since 2003, and we've done them every 2 years since then. So it's just a disconnect exists And that's what I was talking about in the very beginning. You don't have to necessarily be technical, but you have to be informed about what's already going on in the community, what terminology matters to them, and what their priorities are.
Yeah, so I think one thing that sort of has really captured people's imaginations, or certainly has captured sort of the DHS worst nightmare, is this attack on the power grid in Ukraine, right? That was sort of viewed as, see, we'd warned about the power grid for a long time. Now we're actually seeing sort of vulnerabilities manifest in ways that that might actually be brought to bear on the United States, or that we should sort of be worried about this. And we saw a lot of, you know, high-level sort of people in NPPD and other parts of DHS sort of going out to really use this as the use case to try and raise awareness. One of the things that seems like a tension point is sort of the not wanting to be so general as to be useless, right? We have these conversations at really, really high levels of sort of platitudes and generalities, you know, that mask a lot of the differences you're talking about, right? The differences between industrial control systems and, you know, corporate email servers, right? Just really, really different things. The other sort of piece of that is the sort of the overly specific, right? The fact that we're always sort of in this reactive place in which something happens and then we think about how to prevent that precise thing from happening in a way that potentially we aren't learning broad enough lessons. So, you know, and I open this to anyone who has thoughts on it. You know, right, you are a responsible member of Congress. You are sort of, you're somebody who wants to do the right thing. You see a scary story coming out of a foreign country. You have DHS that's sort of concerned and is saying we really need to pay attention to this. What should you be focused on? How should you be thinking about these issues? How should staffers be educating themselves? Sort of like, what exactly in practical terms should these groups of people be doing in terms of either informing themselves or like breaking down these problems in a way that is responsive and useful?
Yeah, so I'll take the first shot at this. So some very interesting things came out of the case study you mentioned, the Ukraine 2015. So I was able to be the lead investigator on that case from the private sector aspect and got invited to do some of the incident response work and ended up writing the report on it to the industry. And when I was done with the case, and actually we were done with all of our analysis, it happened in December 2015, we were done with our analysis in the beginning of January, I was concerned that sort of coming back to the U.S. discussion, that I would be spending the next year trying to de-hype the discussion, because it was a very serious threat, a very serious thing. But I thought the natural spin of the industry was going to make it this doom and gloom apocalyptic scenario. I was surprised to find the exact opposite. And I had found that the DHS and other sectors of the government, as well as one of the reliability coordinators, NERC, was downplaying the scenario, saying, don't worry, it can't happen here, and completely ignoring it. The first time the U.S. government even acknowledged that it happened to the public was through the ICS cert 2 months and 1 day after the attack happened. So, you know, eventually they changed their narrative some, and eventually, you know, after we briefed the industry and the, you know, we had CEOs of major power companies calling Congress members to say, hey, what, you know, what the heck is going on? Eventually they changed the narrative and said, oh, yep, it could happen here, but don't worry, it's not that bad. And I'll just sort of note that it is not an apocalyptic scenario, but it absolutely was a bad scenario, and there was many case studies that we could have taken advantage of and didn't. So to answer your question a little bit more directly, one of the first things that the government and really congressional members sort of tasking the staffers and things should be aware of is the natural tendency of bureaucracy, and I think they should be well aware of that by now, to sort of maybe push back on these deliverables that we're getting from DHS or internal agencies and be sure to engage the private sector to make sure that the whole picture is being represented, because you'll want to make decisions off sort of the accurate view, if you will. The other thing that I'll note is the government is very reaction-based in terms of, oh my gosh, a power grid outage just happened in Ukraine. Let's think about regulations and standards and, you know, government-organized response plans. And sometimes there's already a lot of good things going on in the industry. It wasn't always that way, but we're definitely finding that these days. And so the narrative is probably best around, okay, how do we help the nuanced discussion? How do we communicate and create situational awareness for the industry in the way that the credibility that the government brings? And how do we support the ongoing efforts of the private sector? You know, the power grid, as an example, has a massive amount of regulations on it, $1 million a day type fines for out of compliance of the NERC SIP standards. It would be much more appropriate at this point to be able to have things like tax credits to incentivize folks to be able to do cybersecurity training for people that need it. We still have not had a White House level member or any senior level government member come out and even acknowledge the attack or condemn the attack. And not only did it happen in 2015, but it happened again in 2016, where a foreign power took down portion of the Ukrainian power grid. So if anybody is looking and thinking, well, this is a Ukraine issue, we're not going to comment on it, they're sorely missing the picture that a lot of this can happen, and a lot of this is likely messaging to what can happen in the United States power grid.
So I think this is interesting, right, because this kind of underlies at least three things in terms of, like, practical, you know, what can you do in response to an event? Well, the first is there is a tremendous amount of activity in government already on a lot of, especially in terms of response planning around critical infrastructure, that it, I think, is helpful when staffers are able to reach out to particular individuals, either at DHS, broader within the community, or in the private sector as well, just to understand what existing set of response plans and scenarios are already in place. And that's not necessarily a substantive education deficit, that's just a question of situational awareness. But it's one where if we assume nothing's being done, then it cuts off a lot of these existing sources of information. The second, though, I think, is that there are some good resources. You know, Nick Leiserson, who works with Representative Langevin, is part of this group, the Cybersecurity Caucus in the House, that does a nice job putting together briefings and events for staffers, but also publishing, regularly putting out event information. And so if you're a staffer, if you're an individual who has to sort of write the memo, write the two-page response on something, reach out to colleagues that know, or who you know are knowledgeable on this issue, because there is, I think, a slowly emerging network on the Hill and elsewhere in D.C. that is good on these issues. And if they can't give you a good response, can connect you to somebody else. So that network becomes really critical, because as you've pointed out, right, absent the Cabbage Patch nightmare, no one's really going to have enough information to be able to respond effectively or truly understand most of what we're talking about. The third thing, though, and I think Rob points it up very well, is not necessarily even for those staffers, but for individuals in the private sector to reach into this debate, become involved, and understand who the key players are. Josh Corman and Bo Woods, who are respectively director and associate director at the Atlanta Council Cyber Statecraft Initiative, wrote one of our chapters on cyber auto safety. And they've been working on this issue as part of the I Am the Cavalry process for an extended period of time and are now sort of institutionalized here in the city. But they have had a tremendous amount of success reaching into the policy process and engaging with the community to try and highlight not only concerns on particular issues, but also existing activities in the private sector to bring a little bit more coordination into play. So I think that that's something, and you know, Rob's a great example of this, where he is writing and talking constantly all over the map. And that's been a really good resource for people to be able to reach out to and say, give me a sense of where this is. Is this a catastrophe? Is this a minor issue? Should I ignore it?
Yeah, so I mean, clearly sort of the ownership of expertise and having better ways to sort of permeate the relevant communities is, I think, is going to be critical here. One of the things that is problematic is that sometimes sort of a particular idea or solution really tends to capture the imagination of certain groups, and it's not always clear why that's the case. You know, so for sort of me personally, sort of the vulnerabilities equities process and the notion that putting that into law is going to solve problems, I don't mind the idea, but it's always, you know, there are certain things that have baffled me as to why do you think this is the most important issue, or why has this sort of taken root with congressional staffers or members in such a specific way? You know, sort of pivoting to Jane's chapter on sort of software liability, that is one issue area in which it really feels like the lawyers have sort of grabbed it, yes, and been like, yes, indeed, we have the solution here. This is it, yes, right? Like, did they get it wrong? What is the part that you, what is the narrative that you wish would sort of go away, and what should it be replaced with?
You know, it's funny, in honor of Rob's question, which was how do we create a more nuanced discussion as a general matter, I think that I'm going to start by no longer using the phrase software liability. Maybe we can use the phrase software accountability, because liability, even for lawyers, can be, I mean, it's
at least in the software context, we don't mean private cause of action. We don't mean lawsuits, endless lawsuits for every vulnerability that's exploited. And so given that, word confuses even lawyers who are treading for the first time into the space. We should probably not even use it. So that's the first thing. This idea that the public imagination has been captured in certain ways by specific topics in the cyber realm, I really think of that as us sort of, we're looking where the light is, right? Where when we see something that's identifiable or potentially understandable to laymen, I think we seize upon it as a solution or as the dispositive way to understand the problem. And so it's the effects are quite disturbing, but they can be interesting to look at. And in the software accountability space, I would suggest we think about sort of the cultural reasons why this is happening. In my chapter, I argue that one of the reasons why we're so resistant to software accountability mechanisms of any kind, in fact, we shut down the conversation before people in the conversation can know what we're talking about. One of the reasons for that is it's not just, you know, corporate greed or however the conversation has been caricatured. It's actually because code itself is a very special currency in the culture of the moment. I think of code is the currency of innovation. When we talk about code, we talk about possibility. And so the idea of burdening code, taxing the coding and the application development process strikes even the average, you know, the average like WhatsApp user as abhorrent. And so because we're not willing to think about slowing down the fast rate at which we've been able to enjoy the fruits of Silicon Valley, we're not able to talk about accountability in a serious way.
So let's sort of take a step back and describe what is the problem in this space, right? Sort of what is the software accountability problem?
I think you can break down the problem or the misunderstandings in probably three ways. One is a misunderstanding about what kind of accountability mechanisms are we talking about. The second one is, what is the metric by which we would determine that a company was falling down on the coding game? And the third one is, what are the consequences for the industry at large and for smaller companies that are trying to break in if we do adopt accountability mechanisms? So just to tackle that first question, which is generally speaking my fixation, what kind of accountability are we talking about? Number one, I think it's important here to understand limitations between the analogy of, you know, software and conventional products like cars. A lot of times we talk about, oh, cars cause damage and we expect liability. So software causes damage, so we should also expect liability. I think that analogy has some usefulness, especially when we're talking about actual embedded software in cars, but there are limitations. When we talk about software, a lot of times we're just talking about computer application software. We're talking about no clear property damage, though often, you know, we are talking about theft, and we're often not talking about personal injury. And so we're in a different space. So we should recognize that. We should also recognize that if you're talking about a vulnerability that's been exploited, this could affect millions of users. And so it's not going to make sense to say everybody has a private cause of action and can go into court. In light of that difficulty, the nature of the damage, the nature of the harm, we should already be talking about things like regulatory fines. We should be talking about these much more modest measures for ensuring that companies actually feel the costs of their bad coding practices. So regulatory fines is something that the Federal Trade Commission is already pursuing, starting in 2013. And my big hope is that the current administration is supportive of those efforts to impose liability, very limited fines on companies that really, really lose the ball, drop the ball on their software, either coding or software customization. The second metric, just really quickly, this idea that there's an idea out there that software liability or accountability means imposing liability every time there's a vulnerability that's exploited. That is definitely the wrong way to look at the problem. That's not feasible given the number of vulnerabilities we're talking about in every piece of complex software. We need to be thinking about, oh, how can we institute a system by which we start looking at the processes by which companies have developed this code? There are ways to look at the extent to which companies are falling short of industry standard. We should look at those. That should be the metric that we use.
Right. I think this is interesting. I mean, and it's important to recognize, too, this is an administration that has come out already and made a point of emphasizing the role of the marketplace in designing solutions for some of these public policy problems. The President's Homeland Security Advisor, Tom Bossert's done some interesting work on this, and I think has articulated clearly that there's a preference for the free market to, with properly assigned, aligned incentives, to try to develop some of the solution space here. And the things that Jane's talking about, particularly with regard to transparency and enforcement of process, right, secure software development practices, but also transparency of performance and behavior. So I don't necessarily, if I'm the FTC, I don't necessarily have to go and sanction every single company every time a vulnerability is found. It would be a tremendous resource for them to catalog, record, and publish vulnerability disclosures and patches in that company's software. So if I'm an organization going to buy two database management systems, I can look and see one of them has had 100 vulnerabilities in the last year and the other has had 3, and infer from that their respective software development practices. That gives me information that allows me to make a more informed choice. We did an event actually at the Wilson Center, and you know, you put your hands up and you ask staffers or anyone in the room, how do you choose between browsers? Do you have any information on the security performance of those applications? And almost nobody has a real good way to say it, unless they're really in the weeds and they're tracking, you know, pwn-to-own exploit results and these sorts of things. So I think the point that's being made is a very good one. It does not have to be strict sanctions or strict liability or accountability of any kind like that. It really would help just to have good information in the marketplace.
Right. And the government has a role to play there in a limited, even if you have a limited conception of what the government should be doing, it's very clear the government has a role to play in just information dissemination. I think the obvious example here is when the Obama administration invited Mudge and Sarah Zatko to develop the Cyber Independent Testing Lab. And the idea there is to actually run static analysis of binary software files and actually use algorithms to offer people a metric for how secure software is. What's interesting about this is people have been talking about rating systems for forever. But when you finally have an administration that's willing to say, hey, we're willing to fund this or willing to sponsor this or support this, and you have someone out there who is then able to use their expertise to provide it in sort of a splashy, headline-grabbing way, what you will have is enough people who actually utilize that rating service, and you will have competitors enter into the market because, let's say, they don't like how the algorithms are done or they don't think it's the fairest way to gauge and judge. Well, then they can introduce their own system. And what you will have at that point is a proliferation, hopefully, of rating systems that people can use, sort of the way you use Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic and whatever it is for your movies.
So I'll sort of go around the room and whatever room Rob is currently in and ask... what are sort of the opportunities you see this somewhat disruptive administration presenting, to borrow a Silicon Valley favored phrase? Right, clearly there's, in lots and lots of areas, they think about things rather differently than they have before. And are there, what do you see as sort of a potential opportunity there? And then sort of the converse of that, where are the areas in which we've made progress, or there are areas of broad agreement that look like they might be reopened now, or we might be sort of taking a step back, right? So sort of what are the pros and cons of where we are, specifically sort of with respect to whatever changes this new administration presents? So Rob, are you, do you want to give us some, ray of optimism or pessimistic outlook? How do you think about this?
I'm more of a optimist anyways. I will say under any administration, and given that this one has definitely been sort of emotional for people, I recognize it seems like an outlier, but I would say under any administration, the private sector is going to be pushing forward regardless. And there are going to be massive gains had in security, especially for my niche area of industrial control systems, but really in the larger discussion over the next couple of years. I also think, we've never seen the vast majority of cyber policy focused folks under a Republican administration even to begin with. I mean, it's been largely a newer narrative in the community. So the last 8 years of up and coming cyber policy focused folks has been under a Democrat sort of administration. So it's going to be turmoil regardless in terms of getting people together and thinking about these problems from different points of view. But I'm an optimist. I'm not necessarily the biggest supporter of the administration, but I look at it and say, we're going to push forward. So where do I hope they push forward on? Well, I hope that the Republican base around creating jobs and sort of their big narrative around, you know, trade schools and things like that. I hope that continues over into the industrial control system community with a focus on making sure that we do things like incentivize the sector instead of more regulations. I hope we have more things like tax credits. I think when we look at industrial control system security specifically, you know, we look at how many people we have. We have less than 1,000 ICS security professionals in the world. Most of them are in the United States, given the focus we put over the last couple decades, but that's not enough people. So I think it's a fair statement to make that we may not know the right way forward, that we need a lot more people from industry who are trained and professionals and able to help us find that right way forward, both in technology, policy, and actual practices. So that's the area I'd like to see more education for the folks. In the short run, since education can take some time, in the short run, I would hope that we have more engagement of the private sector industry, kind of like what has been, you know, sort of focused on throughout the discussion by all parties, just making sure that the government can reach out to people, staffers can reach out to the right experts. And, you know, there is a DC bubble at times, especially on the cybersecurity narrative. There is a distinct difference in what goes on between the coasts and what goes on the coasts themselves. So to bridge that, instead of just hoping that DHS is going to be the solution, which, you know, I think they have a lot of wonderful people at DHS, but I don't think anyone of serious tone can say that DHS has been a success in engaging industry writ large and providing some sort of magic cybersecurity solution. So I think as we break outside of that DC bubble and engage the rest of the industry, we will find a very optimistic path forward, and that's mostly what's needed.
I think the Trump administration has a massive opportunity here because cyber is one of those realms in which Republicans and Democrats can very much come together in a bipartisan way to address sort of potentially sweeping changes in how we think about cyber and what kind of policies we enact. I think my big thing, specifically as it relates to software, would be think about consolidation. Information consolidation. We talk about transparency a lot. We talk about public education a lot for, like, you know, cyber user hygiene purposes. But the truth is, all of those measures are going to be of limited effect if people can't go to, like, a place to learn what they need to learn, or one agency. I think it was Dan Kaminsky who recently suggested the creation of something like an NIH of cyber. To fund serious research, security research. And I think there are pros and cons to an idea like that, but something that he is getting at is what the FTC right now is trying to do piecemeal, and what you have, like, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration trying to do when it comes to software and cars. You have all of these agencies that see problems affecting different pieces of the industry, and they're all trying to suggest things that can be done, but it's all over the place. The information is everywhere. When you're researching these things, it's funny how many agency websites you have to go to even understand and get a lay of the land as to what's happening. And so some sort of umbrella movement, even if not within a particular agency, even a website to understand what the government is doing about cyber issues, that would be so helpful. It would be a baby step and yet so helpful.
I think this health model is a good segue for this, right? There are a lot of opportunities for this administration to embrace the private sector and help it function both better and more efficiently on cybersecurity, picking better products, rewarding best practices in security, both by vendors as well as by organizations that implement software. And I think it goes in line with a lot of the sort of market-oriented rhetoric that's come out so far. So I would hope very much to see expansion on, but really driving information disclosure about practices and performance and security by people who are themselves targeted for breaches, but also building software and rolling code. It's something that's missing from a lot of the discussion for consumers often, and it's a little disconcerting that that's the case. The other, though, is in terms of a potential point of de-emphasis, I think Rob's point about private sector engagement is really critical. There's been some bits and pieces that make it sound as if DOD is going to become the lead cyber agency or the cyber agency entirely. And I think there's obviously a huge role for DOD to play, especially with its assets in the intelligence community. But it would be a mistake to roll back the progress that's been made, especially in the Department of Commerce, but I think also DHS, in working with the private sector, not just to understand and engineer solutions, but to start to share best practices and allow government to encourage rather than require solutions and discussion in the space. So putting that at DoD doesn't prevent those conversations from taking place, but it makes them substantially more complicated. So that's an area where we could potentially really, I think, reverse some of the progress that's been made in the last couple of years.
I'm completely moved to see such optimists in this realm. Usually it's all doom and gloom. So just to let you plug your book, so you're a congressional staffer who has been inspired by this conversation and the many opportunities. Where do they get the book?
So visit cyberinsecuritybook.org. You can also reach out to us there. The one thing I'd call out as well is it's an edited volume. So I think we've had a lot of success in elevating voices that haven't been a huge part of the conversation so far, but also from a really varying mix of perspectives. There's computer scientists, there's policy practitioners at the state and local level, at the national level, there's lawyers. And so seek out those individuals. If you're working on a topic, there's some sample chapters and a table of contents up on the website. But if you see something you're interested in, you're curious about, reach out to that person. There is, I think, a chance for this to be a good guide for building your network on this topic as well.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us. And
thanks for
I'm
going to
just shove cyber insecurity through everybody's mailboxes at the Senate until they come up with a solution.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. As always, our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, and elsewhere. And if you haven't already, please give us a rating and review in the iTunes store. As always, thanks for listening.